Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the 7-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for the Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
Buzz around artificial intelligence is seemingly everywhere. Is your portfolio keeping up? Consider the Global X Artificial Intelligence and Technology ETF, ticker AIQ, which invests in dozens of stocks at the leading edge of this disruption. Investing involves risk, including possible loss of principal. Technology companies can be affected by rapid product obsolescence and intense industry competition. Before investing, carefully consider the fund's objectives, risks, charges, expenses, and more in the full or summary prospectus at globalxetfs.com. Read carefully. Distributed by SEI Investments Distribution Co.
Achtung, Achtung, or is it alarm, alarm? Welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk, the Second World War podcast for all your Second World War podcast needs. James, how are you?
Yeah, well, I'm all right.
Jim, in a strange way, are you sure your mood isn't directly influenced by your subject matter? I remember when you were writing about the band of brothers, the Sherwood Rangers, although it was horrible, it was all about how led beautifully by Stanley Christopherson, and in the end they were a family, and that's how they were all looking out for each other. No matter what vagaries came, the vagaries of fate came their way, the bonhomie would get them through. And you were very like that when you were writing that, and now you're writing about Italy.
I'm under so much pressure.
I can't get it done.
I know. At the moment, they're in Anzio. They're fighting on the Garigliano in the south. They've 36 divisions has just all gone tits up.
Yeah.
But they've still got to do another feint with the one regiment that they haven't used.
Yeah.
34th Red Bulls is doing an attack, and the CEF is doing the French are doing an attack on the top. And you've got to describe what they've got to do, how they've got to do it, and where they are. There's only so many ways you could describe a valley and a mountain.
We were going to do some questions today, weren't we? Which actually leads me to the first question I wanted to do, which is from Chris A. Do you think that the Allies sometimes should have listened more to their scientists, inventors, and visionaries to help win the war quicker? What do you think, Jim?
I think that's exactly what they did.
Listened
to their scientists. Half of Churchill's government was full of kind of technocrats and chief scientists, and you think of all those big scientists,
Charwell and Solly Zuckerman and all those people,
all those guys. I mean, they're talking, but the whole thing is a massive experiment in science. I mean, I don't really understand why you would think anything else.
I still think about.
You know, when we were talking to Roland White about the mosquito raid in Copenhagen in March 1945, and you think of those mosquitoes speeding across at kind of 400 miles an hour at rooftop height and delivering a kind of precision weapon on a precise target. And you think, my God, how far they've come since 1940. And if that's not development of science, I don't know what is. And then, ultimately, obviously, it ends to the atomic bomb, which is about the most complex piece of science you could possibly imagine.
Yeah.
And you think about B-29 and pressurized cabins and operating at 40,000 feet and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's absolutely extraordinary. I mean, I'm not sure that they could have listened to them any more than they did.
Is the shadow of this question that the Germans had boffins and tech and all that and snazzy kit. Is that
yeah? But they misused it. They misdirected it the whole time.
Because after all, you look at what Bomber Command are using in the way of navigational aids and electronic countermeasures. By the end of the war, aircraft are festooned with all sorts of things, and you know, not just the sort of H2S and the things we know about airborne cigar and all that sort of all these really weird things, and that they're playing this technological game of cat and mouse. I don't know.
I mean, if you look at Nazi Germany, I've said it before. By and large, the Western allies, particularly, used their R&D, research and development, and science, and all the rest of it, prioritised it pretty much in the right way. I mean, you know, there's exceptions and there's things that don't go 100% right, and there's sort of pycrete and you know, aircraft carriers made out of ice and wood chips. You know, obviously that's bonkers, and of course it doesn't come to anything. But then you think about the cavity magnetron, you think about developing the Mosquito, you think about 100 Group, you think about Mulberry Harbours, you think about all that, as you say, the radars and navigational aids and technology, you think about armour-piercing discarding sabot ammunition, now absolutely standard, but developed by the British in the war. You think about some of the huge technological and scientific developments by the Americans.
Yeah.
It's absolutely off the radar. And you think about just simple inventions like the landing ship, which is arguably the most important piece of equipment that the Allies developed in the entire war. And these are just remarkable. And you think how fast that happens between 1939 and 1945, and the differences in those sort of nearly 6 years. It's absolutely astonishing. And then you think about the Germans, you think about how they apply their R&D, and you think, yeah, okay, they've got some pretty good weapons, but actually their most effective weapons at the end of the war are the ones that are most simple, like sort of Panzerfaust and Panzerschreck and stuff. And then you think about the weapons that really do make a difference, like the V2, you know, completely misdirected, you could argue. You know, have they not learned the lessons that, you know, cities have been laid waste in Germany, and that hasn't brought about a collapse. So why do you think that kind of less amount of ordnance in London, for example, or Rotterdam is going to make any difference there? It's not, it's bonkers. But if you started applying that into armies, that'd be a completely different kettle of fish, I'd have thought.
Well, you fire it at the Mulberries, and you immediately cancel out.
Or whatever, but And so so that's been misdirected. Then you think about, you know, incredible inventions like the engines that developed into the Type 21 U-boat, which meant it was a proper submarine rather than a submersible, i.e. it could operate faster underwater than it could on the top, and it could stay underwater for hours upon hours at a time. That technology was there in 1939, but wasn't developed until, you know, effectively until first operational Type 21 U-boats in April 1945, by which time it's too late. You see the Germans time and time again, you know, applying the wrong lessons and not making the most of their extraordinary scientists. And also, of course, the regime, because of its ideology, driving away some of their very best scientists into the arms of the Allies.
You've got to be a Nazi Party member. You've got to, you know, you think of von Braun, the things that he did in order to make sure that he could get his rockets away, and the things he was prepared to turn a blind eye to, supposedly, or was enthusiastically into, you know, which we shall never know, actually, how he felt about the slave labor use and all that sort of stuff, and his SS membership. You had to do all that, whereas you didn't have to be a member of the Conservative Party or the Labour Party in order to, you know, work on a cavity magnetron or whatever. I mean, it's interesting, because one of the post-war pictures of the British sort of technological effort is there's a couple of boffins who shine through, you know, like R.V. Jones, like Barnes Wallace, people like that. But actually, they're part of an enormous industrial, I mean, they're basically part of the military-industrial complex, to use an anachronism, exists in Britain because Britain, you know, has fought an enormous First World War, has a giant Vickers. You think of Vickers Armstrong, when you have a thing as big and as technologically complex and modern as the Royal Navy, cooking along in the 20s and 30s, because you have to, because you're running a global empire, you're keeping global shipping going and all that sort of stuff. You know, you have a depth of expertise, depth of scientific innovation that is just part of the country's muscle structure, let alone its muscle memory, right? Yep. And that's what comes, you know, the fact that we know of these star inventors, you think of the people around Barnes Wallace, the staff he would have had, the engineers he could rely on, the planners, that you know, when we talked about the Downs Raid last year, actually how quickly they rustle that up. And basically they're flying with a prototype because they've been told there's no time at all and they need to get it done very, very quickly, the dams raid. That isn't a single boffin. That's a whole infrastructure, a whole culture, in fact, of invention, of scientists, inventors and visionaries, isn't it, basically?
And also, I think there's an extraordinary ability to kind of think outside the box. You know, Zolly Zuckerman is a case in point because, you know, he's a zoologist, isn't he? I mean, or whatever.
Yeah,
he is.
He's a zoologist.
He's not... Yeah, you know, and he ends up kind of doing experiments with bombs.
He's looking at reproduction before the war. So his thing is, his expertise in that is what is able to guide his understanding of injury, bomb injury, and because he's an anatomist and he looks at anatomy and the effect of stuff on anatomy. Joey has popped up on here, who's our producer, and says, did they spend too much time listening to scientists? I mean, one of the really interesting things at Bletchley they wanted to talk about Friday when I was there is that they are... fascinatingly, because they've got this film about D-Day, about the intelligence effort around D-Day, but the thing in the center of the film is the lads on the landing craft. That the entire point of all of this scientific effort, all this, you know, this boffining that's going on at Bletchley, and Bletchley really actually it's more like a battery farm than anything else, isn't it? It's mass production. Of code breaking. The point of it all is to make the life easier of the fellas on the landing craft, that, you know, that you can anticipate what the enemy's going to do, and it's a steel not flesh application. Let's do another one. I love the Mighty Eighth series, says Michael, and thanks very much for listening to that and enjoying it. What was the Luftwaffe pilot's view of the B-17? Did they see them as easy pickings or an opponent not to be underestimated?
Even if they're kind of flying slow and easy to, you know, comparatively easy to pick on, they're still each producing 13 times 50 caliber machine guns, which are all firing at you. So,
yeah,
you know, no, they're pretty circumspect. And, you know, flying head on to a B-17 and B-17 formation requires unbelievable bravery and pilot skill to do it effectively.
Yeah.
So this was Galland, General Galland, who was the General de Flieger. He was a kind of fighter commander, and his tactics were to, which he worked out himself in the summer of 1943, were to fly head on at a shallow angle and then skim over the top of it, still firing. And that was the best way to do it. But it's not easy, and the number of planes that were shot down, not just by American fighter planes, but also by bombers, was huge.
And that's because,
of course, is they had lots and lots and lots of them, and they weren't very well trained. But you know, as a fighter pilot, that amount of lead flying around the air, you've got to be very careful.
And he figures it in terms of because on the earlier. Because I think the B-17 in people's minds very often is the silver one with the chin turret. That there was a remote controlled chin turret. The early marks didn't have that, did they? And they had one 30 caliber. No. It was a 30 cal on the front of the aircraft. And right. So it was the most weakly defended point of the plane. Galland's just thinking, well, you know, we've got to try and reduce.
And also, it's the best way to get the pilot. And if you get the pilot,
that as well. Yeah, you've got to try and improve the odds. And so don't fly at the bit with all the machine guns. You know, fly at the bit with the least machine guns on it.
All very well, isn't it? A formation of B-17s all firing at you is fraught with problems and was incredibly costly. It's just they had lots of them. The other thing, of course, is that all the problems that the fortresses had taking off into fog and all the rest of it. I mean, you know, these were all the same problems that the Luftwaffe are having. You know, you take off in a frisky ME-109 with its narrow undercarriage and immense torque and very high wing loading, and you're not quite up to par, and number of accidents and collisions and all the rest of it was absolutely legion. I mean, 50% of their losses by this stage, by 1944.
Mackie Steinhoff writes about it, doesn't he? They call them Boeings, don't they?
Yeah, he's
called
Boeings.
And in his Messerschmitts over Sicily, you know, he says, you know, they're told that they get a visit, don't they? They get a visit from who goes, right, listen, you lot. We figured it out back in the fatherland. This is what you need to do. You need to fly right at them, straight at them. And basically Steinhoff's going, you know, this is ridiculous. You know, no thanks. We're not going to do that. But they do it. He does it. And it's, you know, there's nothing but terror in it, you know, the way he describes it. And this is
And also the individual squadrons, the Staffel, are also suffering really, really badly. So a squadron of fighter pilot, American fighter pilots, would be like 45 strong, something like that, to get 16 airborne. Well, Staffel is 12 to get 12 airborne. And very often you never had, very rarely would you have full 12 available on any given morning. So usually it's kind of 8, 7, 6, nine, that kind of thing. And so the losses are much more keenly felt, because even more so than cruising a bomber station, because you're such a tight unit of such a small number of men. So the flow of personnel is just absolutely enormous. Every time they're going out, they're losing someone. In the same way as the Mighty 8 are, they're losing crews. But as a proportion of their whole, it's greater. They are losing 15 to 20% every time they go out, whereas that's exceptionally bad for the 98th. And it's all relative, of course, because the numbers are much greater with the amount of crews in the 8th Air Force. But it's a horror story. So yes, how do they think of them? They thought of them as lethal bits of kit that you need to shoot down as many as possible, but be very, very wary of.
But the whole thing was a nightmare. But the whole thing's a nightmare. Relentless.
The whole thing's
nightmare.
A nightmare. Yeah. Because, I mean, when you're on the receiving end of something, you think your enemy always holds the aces. But it cuts both ways. I think that's the point.
I mean, we need to go to break now, Jim. Although this is there's a pile of questions stimulated by our Mighty 8th season, I think it's fair to say, including the perennial mosquito question. Anyway, we will see you after this break. Cheerio.
Hi, I'm Ben. I suffer from a condition called writer's block. It strikes when I'm at work. That's why I choose Canva Magic Write. It works fast, generating texts in seconds, thanks to AI.
Common side effects include increased productivity, compliments from coworkers, feelings of satisfaction.
Now I can say bye-bye to writer's block.
Ask your boss if Canva Magic Write is right for you at canva.com, designed for work.
Canva. You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk, where Jim and I are doing what we can manfully to answer your questions. Though I think we have answered a few. I mean, there's a lot more questions on this piece of paper on this page than we have answered, but we're having a go. Do you remember that live cast where we tried to answer 20 questions in an hour and completely failed? Do you remember that?
Yeah, it was absolutely hopeless, wasn't it? We were going to go, right, okay, stopwatch, no more than 2 minutes per question.
We should try that again, I think, at some point.
At some point.
So Jason Hoffman asks, after listening to the Mighty 8th series, I still have a thought. Why did the US Army Air Force stick with the 10-crew B-17 when the Mosquito could carry the same bomb load to Berlin but only risk a crew of two? I'll give a simple answer, which is that these things are often chauvinistic. The Mosquito isn't an American invention, so they're not going to do that.
that only holds to a certain point, I think. It's not just so easy to just, in the middle of a war, kind of change your entire strategy and production schedules and all the rest of it. You know, there's all lots of factors. So when you're creating a new aircraft, you've got to create it, then you've got to build it, then you've got to set up the factories, then you've got to have, first of all, you've got to have the machine tools to create those specific aircraft. That's an incredibly complicated bit. So the machinery that is designed to create that particular thing, and then you've got to duplicate those, then you've got to put them out in the factory. So mid-war, when you're in the middle of something, that's actually quite a process.
Yeah.
In the summer of 1943, United States Army Air Force thought that the B-17 was going to cut it.
Yeah, yeah.
Then it became clear that it wasn't going to cut it. Then by the middle of 1944, a little bit longer. So if they were going to change it, the time to change it would have been the second half of 1943.
Yeah.
But how long is it going to take to change it? Realistically, they wouldn't have enough Mosquitoes to be able to change over. You could start changing over a few squadrons maybe early on in 44. But basically, you're talking about a kind of a year in which to change it. Yeah. So a year from the end of 1943 is to the end of 1944, by which time the B-17 is doing just fine.
Well, and also...
And there's lots of them.
Also, your entire training scheme is about 10-man aircrews. You've got to completely rejig your 10-man air crew thing, haven't you?
Yes, and I think also the other thing is
doing with the other 8 lads, because you know that they aren't all pilot material, because that's part of the sifting that's gone on. So what do you do with those other boys? And I mean the other thing here is American industry's great advice, you know, that aside, the idea that changing that thing mid-flow is really difficult. That aside, American industry's great advantage here, unlike the Germans, who are under constant pressure from aerial bombing and from the, you know, Allied strategic bombing campaign, you can set up a factory that will just produce something for the war with the modifications as you want, as you go, without ever having to change it if you don't want to. You know, you get the feedback from the customer, as it were, that the things need to be altered and you need a chin turret or whatever, which is the B-17G. But you don't need, why would you interfere with that advantage, which is what you've got here? Always, no. The other thing here to remember is no one knows when, I've been thinking about this more and more and more recently, no one knows when the war's going to end. So no one knows. You know, the relentless pressure on the bomber offensive is to get it done, get the war over with, finish the war as quickly as possible. And if you interrupt your production schedule by changing to a different bomber altogether, that will slow the war down from that point of view, right? Won't it? That will mean you're not going to finish the war as soon as possible. Because Tammy Davis Biddle writes really well about this. This how do you end up? You go from pickle barrel bombing, which is the conviction of the US Army Air Force at the start of the war, to little boy. And you go that distance in 4 years, don't you? From America entering the war to the dropping the atomic bomb. How on earth do you get from there to there? Well, it's you're trying to end the war as quickly as possible. All the pressure that manifests itself, you know, why does Acre change his mind? Why do people change their mind about as they proceed through the war? Why do the thinkers in the American Air Force change their mind? Because in the end, they're trying to get the war over with. They're trying to finish the war as soon as possible.
I've literally just written that line this morning in the casino book.
Really?
The reason they're doing all this, the reason why they're hammering away at the Gustav line at Casino, is not because it's fun. It's because they're trying to win the war as quickly as possible.
Egan said it in the episode of Masters of the Air the other day. He articulates it. He says, we need to end this war before more people like that are killed, before more of you die, before more of us die, is the point. When you've got the advantage of a production line that's churning out a bomber that can do 250 knots once it's dropped its bombs and, you know, and at altitude and is heavily defended, and you're wedded to a policy. Let's not forget the unescorted bomber policy is people have made their minds up that it's going to work and they're going to make it work one way or another. You're not going to change your advantages, which is mass production, and it's actual mass production. You know, after all, British mass production is artisanal, you know, workshop mass production. So it's even then, it's not as streamlined and sufficient. Why would you do that? But that's how you go from pickle barrel bombing to atomic bombing by the end of the war, which couldn't be more different to one another. And the impetus for pickle barrel bombing is, how do we end the war as quickly as possible? By knocking out some very specific targets which will paralyze the German economy. The fact we don't know what they are, the fact that that won't work when we put that into practice when we get to Northwest Europe, those are impediments that we will overcome, you know, and they end up overcoming those impediments. Area bombing blindly with radar, and then in the end, night bombing Tokyo from very low altitude to firebomb the Japanese into surrender, you know, because they're trying to get it finished, desperate to end the war as soon as possible. And I think that in the end is why you don't switch to 2-man crew Mosquito.
Well, I think there's two other reasons which I think are actually the kind of as important as the kind of shifting production lines. The first one is that actually I don't think the Mosquito would have been suitable in the role as daylight precision (inverted commas) bomber. Because you still need to be at kind of 18,000 feet, and at 18,000 feet rather than 35,000 feet, Mosquito is as vulnerable as as anything else. I mean, it's a bit small of a target, I suppose, but, you know, it's made of wood and all the rest of it, and it's only got 2 engines, not 4, and it's got no protection. You know, it has got protection, but not very much. And I'm not sure. I mean, I suppose you could have used it as a fighter, but a fighter of a mosquito's caliber against a 109 or a Fokker Wolf 190, you know, I think that's problematic. I don't, you know, it's not designed to be a daylight precision bomber, really. It's supposed to be a low-level bomber or operating at night. And I think the main reason, though, of course, is the Americans are developing a second-generation bomber, which is even better than anything that's come before, which is the B-29.
That's
the route they've gone down. You know, they've made that call. So they're not going to suddenly go, oh, having invested, turned the B-29 into the most expensive armaments project ever in the history of the United States up to that point, and that includes the atomic bomb, to then shift tack and go, actually, should we scrap it and just go for the Mosquito instead? It just ain't going to happen. Yeah. And frankly, the B-29, with its pressurized cabin, you know, greater payload, huge amounts of armament, blah, 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 is a much better bet for what the Americans are trying to do globally than the Mosquito.
Well, but even then, they abandoned it, the style of bombing it's been designed for, because the stratosphere over Japan is... you know, it's too difficult for them to deal with. They end up.
Yeah, but it's incredibly effective operating at 18,000 feet, isn't it? Or at 10,000 feet.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable.
Yeah, but even more effective when they come in at night, not at daylight.
But can you imagine if 500 B-29s had been starting to sweep over Europe, what Germany would have looked like at the end of the war?
There'd have been more rubble being bombed, yes.
That's my point. But I think that's why, is that, you know, they've gone down that particular route.
Philip asks the question. Recently, James did his Cockleshell Heroes paddle. Yes, he did. And
it wasn't Cockleshell Heroes. It was just a paddle.
It was a paddle, exactly.
But I didn't go down the Gironde.
No, they didn't go down the Gironde. No.
But I did experience similar circuits, similar conditions to the mouth of the Gironde. I wouldn't recommend doing it in daylight, let alone night in December.
Philip says, in talking about it, we mentioned someone else who recreated a similar feat in Norway as well, which was on foot. Was that Ray Mears doing the Telemark escape? I think he did.
No, it's Operation Musketoon. Musketoon was 11th to the 21st of September 1942. It's a raid on the Glomfjord power plant at the end of the Glomfjord, which is quite a long way up in Norway. It's number 2 commando plus some Norwegian special forces who are part of SOE, Special Operations Executive. Yeah. And they get there by submarine, but they have to go. They have to paddle up the submarine can only go so far because of torpedo nets and whatever.
Yeah.
So they get in their Klepper boats and they paddle and then they cross over to the next valley into the Glomfjord, blow the thing up, cross back again. There's all sorts of close shaves and hairy moments and all the rest of it, and get away again. It's great. It's a really good story.
So Philip asks, I wonder what your top 10 or top 5 feats of physical endurance and partial insanity of the war that you know of.
Okay. I can think of quite a few.
Well, I'd say the first Chindi expedition. I mean...
Yeah, I would say the second Chindi expedition, because my old my village GP kept a diary. He was the MO on one of the brigades, and just to get from where they were landed to getting to position behind the enemy line, they had to walk like 120 miles through jungle, and something like 2/3 of them kind of fell by the wayside due to dengue fever and jaundice and hepatitis and snake bites
chiggers. Everything.
That's kind of because after that, Ben Wilbond and I and Saul and Rob Gallimore, we've all been saying, oh, what are we going to do next? What are we going to do next? The easiest one would be to cross the Pyrenees or actually do the exfil from Bordeaux down to the Pyrenees. But then the other one, obviously, is just any long range desert group operation in the Western desert. I mean, I have been into the West. I've been quite deep into the Western Desert. And I can tell you, it's absolutely not for the faint-hearted.
No, it's
because if anything
place.
Goes wrong, you are stuffed.
Yeah.
You really, really are in big trouble. Yeah. You know, it's very, very huge and there's nothing in it apart from desert. And it is spectacularly hot by night. And, of course, much of the year, spectacularly cold by night and boiling hot by day. So, you know, it is that's testing. The heroes of Telemark, that's pretty testing, not least because they spent most of the winter in a hut on a glacier before they wrote, because didn't they land at something like October, and then I think the actual raid took place in February or something like that,
yeah
following yep. February. Try to recreate that, that's That's quite hot. I'd have thought any of the death marches at the end of the war going from Poland through to Germany. The Bataan death march, that's not much fun.
Anthony Dean Drummond hiding in a cupboard for 11 days after the Battle of Arnhem. I've got to go with that.
That's quite hardcore.
All he had was his water bottle.
And then I think you can take, literally take a pin and to sort of go blindfold and plonk it on literally any escape from in a dinghy in the middle of the Atlantic in the winter after your ship's been sunk.
Right. Well, any of those crews who sit in a dinghy for 2 weeks, 3 weeks.
You're talking about endurance and what people went through and what people suffered.
There's that glider crew who were shot down taking their glider to North Africa, who are in the water for 11 days.
In
the Bay of Biscay, picked up, go back, getting another glider flight to North Africa. With so many of these things, it's the people who, enduring that's one thing. It's then going, all right, I'll go again. Like, what on earth's going on? The people who go, I watched the Munster episode of Master of the Air, episode 5 last night. And the thing they're really getting right in that.
Good. That's my favourite episode so far.
People have got all sorts of funny ideas about the character development and things, that sort of thing. They keep talking about this. The point is that people appear on the station and then they die, and they're gone. And, that's the experience of the men.
I thought that was an amazing episode.
I think the thing it really, really captured. Oh, God, it's just horrendous. The thing it really, really captures is that you've got to get back in the plane tomorrow. You've got to go. And you know what your likely fate is. I thought it was absolutely amazing.
I thought it was absolutely amazing. I thought it was the best one by some distance.
Yeah,
actually.
And the dogfighting in the...
Absolutely stunning.
The dogfighting in the fortress.
Fighting in the B-17.
It was amazing.
But also, I thought the actor that played Rosie Rosenthal did it brilliantly, that sense of... dawning realization. And when they realize they're the only one left, I just thought that was absolutely stunning, that moment. They just did it so well. Sort of mixture of horror, total bewilderment, everything. Absolutely incredible.
William Scharder. I was just watching for the umpteenth time A Bridge Too Far. I was curious why the Allies did not use tactical air support in the fight at the bridge at Arnhem. Well, I can answer that.
Come on.
Second Tactical Air Force were... Ran a proper CAS, close air support campaign with 30 Corps. And the reason they ran a fully integrated turn up and attack cab rank with 30 Corps. And that was because 30 Corps were an integrated part of 2nd Army Group and therefore attack, 2 TAF was how that all worked. It was what they'd been doing all summer since things shook down with the close air support just after D-Day, when they start putting the airfields in the lodgement and all that, right? So 30 Corps have their CAS, their close air support, down with 2nd Tactical Air Force. 1st Airborne Division do not, because 1st Airborne Division are, 1st Allied Airborne Army, well, strictly speaking, are at arm's length from the rest of the army in the way they train, in their integrated communications and all that sort of stuff. Just because they are, because they're not part of 2nd Army Group. They're part of 1st Allied Airborne Army. And Mary Cunningham goes to one Market Garden planning meeting on the 16th of September, so the day before it goes up, right? So 2 TAF are not part of 1st Allied Airborne Army's close air support planning at all. They're not integrated into the planning at all. And
that's just because it's all too last minute and it's too quick.
But it's also just the way that the airborne thing has been set up. It's not part of the rest of...
So it's not Mary Cunningham's fault?
It's not Cunningham's fault, no. But what's interesting is he isn't going, right, what have you got for me? They aren't including him. He isn't chasing up on it. Now, I think a big part of this is there is an expectation that these operations will be cancelled. All right, I've got to go to another bloody 1st Allied Airborne Army planning
thing.
I've got better things to do.
Let me do the stuff that I know is concrete.
Exactly. And in fact, he's invited to one meeting, is the truth. So there's a within... Then also what happens is flak suppression, right? You'd think flak suppression would be a big priority. There is flak suppression that goes in with the first lift, but then weather prevents fighter escort on the second lift, on the second day, on the Sunday. And also there is a bomb line around where First Airborne are expected to be operating, but are not operating because after all things have gone wrong. So as a result, you end up with no flak suppression for the second lift and the third lift, right? Because the CAS are told to stay away because they might be attacking British troops on the ground. Furthermore, you also have this problem that, you know, Arnhem itself is a street fighting environment. The village at Oosterbeek is it's street fighting. Picking targets from the sky in that situation is much, much more difficult, and everyone's fighting at close quarters. So not only is there a problem of a bomb line, there's also the problem of picking your targets in a built-up area is much, much more difficult than in the open countryside in Normandy, where close air support is used to such great effect. So basically, the reason they do use it for garden, but for market, it doesn't work so well. The Americans, US 82nd Airborne, 101st Airborne, they have their close air support worked out. And one of the reasons that the other kicker is that 1st Airborne, their close air support people are American airborne soldiers who drop with them on day one, and their radios don't work. And it's the American radios that fail with the British contingent in Arnhem, and they're the radios that are supposed to deliver close air support, right? So it's basically structurally designed to have the close air support worked out. Institutionally, it isn't there. Their experience doesn't exist because they are not part of how Second Army Group go about their way of war. They're just, you know, they're not, it's not like being, you know, 43rd Wessex Division, who know how to call in air support, who've got it all worked out, who've been doing it for months. They've never done it before, right? So they don't know. So they don't know what the, so the idea that they land on day one and they'll be able to switch on their radios and have their close air support all worked out and running is fanciful at best, right? And then hampered by the fact that 2TAF haven't been involved in the planning, the Second Army Group haven't involved 2TAF in the planning properly, and that First Allied Airborne Army, you know, restrict the close air support that they're offered by putting up a bomb line that means that basically the supply lifts fly into flak because Second Tactical Air Force haven't been allowed to suppress the flak. And I think it's the 23rd later in the battle where close air support first starts operating over the Arnhem area, because basically they've worked out how to do it. They've got it up and running in the five or six days it takes to get a complex system like that up and running when you haven't trained with it. It's the fact that none of these things are in place. That's why they don't use it.
I'm going to do, in literally 1 minute, I'm going to do Philip Cowles' question.
Okay, go on.
Which is, who writes a company's war diaries and how soon after an action are they written? Are they always accurate? Okay, so generally speaking, Philip, it is the intelligence officer. The intelligence officer is usually a subaltern, very often someone who has been in a frontline company and needs a little bit of kind of, you know, time away from the firing line, you know, nerves just starting to fray. Not always, but that's a kind of sort of, you know, a mild rule of thumb. They are supposed to be written every day, but they're not, because obviously if the battalion is in a massive action, then it tends to get written up subsequently. Does the intelligence officer always, or the person who's writing them out, always talk to everyone involved and get the figures absolutely accurate? No. And they are also making sure that they are preserving the integrity of the battalion as well. So quite often a kind of, you know, a sheen is put over events. Times are always, you know, they're invariably at 0730 rather than 737.
Yeah.
And they're approximate. And the assiduousness with which these war diaries are written completely depends on the person who's writing them. They have to be signed off by the lieutenant colonel, battalion commander. But, you know, when everyone's busy, they don't really care. Or sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. You know, in other words, the degree of accuracy can vary massively. And in the time that I've been looking at all this stuff, there's been numerous times where I've come up against war diaries that literally cannot be true because you know other things are happening and they don't all add up. And sometimes you just have to cut a path through multiple diaries. And a classic example of this is when I was doing the Sherwood Ranger stuff. I was looking at all the diary, war diaries of all the various components that were landing on that part of on Green, Jig Red, on Gold Beach, on D-Day, and they all were different. Every single one was different, and you just had to kind of work out a path through it, and it was incredibly complicated. And that's because, of course, they've all got 101 better things to do than write up war diaries.
Well, and they wrote them up hours later, so they, you know, like...
Sometimes days later. Sometimes days later.
Yeah. It's, I mean, it, you know, I'm...
So it depends.
I'm sort of...
You get a practiced eye at these things, though.
Yeah, I'm sort of trying to wriggle my way through the diaries for Arnhem. I mean, you know, what's quite funny, but what's interesting about some of them is how some of them will say a quiet night and you think, well, that's, you know, Commander Royal Artillery at the end of one of the days says a quiet night in general. And you think, what are you saying? The stuff that's going on around you, but that's interesting that their attitude is that it was a quiet night puts you in an idea of their mindset as much as anything else. You know, if you think this is, yeah. if you think things are tickety boo, then you're not, then maybe they're not looking hard enough and all that sort of stuff. I think they're a good skeleton. You know, are they an endoskeleton or an exoskeleton? Are they inside the event or are they outside the event?
Yeah.
That's the question to ask.
They're fascinating. I've got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. I mean, you know, they're just essential bits of kit. That's the bottom line. But very good. Well, anyway, we've got for a few there.
Well, thanks for those questions. Really, thank you. Excellent questions.
Really good.
And we should do some more of that, shouldn't we? I think at some point.
Yeah, we should probably.
Now, don't forget, ladies and gentlemen, we have Ways Festival. Which is from the 18th of July to the 21st of July at Blackpit Brewery next door to Silverstone. It's a weekend of this kind of stuff. You can hang out with us. You can buy us a pint if you insist. All your favourite people from the podcast will be there speaking. There'll be tanks. There will be aircraft. There'll be a lot of the people I've been meeting along the way on my tour, which will be rather nice. I think Amber and Jake, who I met in Clacton at the weekend, I'll look forward to seeing you. Under 16s are free. You can glamp, you can park your car, and you can spend a weekend of war waffle with us. And that's...
What's not to like?
Exactly. As the man once said, what's not to like? So hopefully we'll see you there. We have ways.co.uk. Thanks for listening. Cheerio.
Cheerio.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.